People tend to go into a state of shock, sometimes followed by denial, when they realize the serious threats to our fossil fuel-based civilization. Everything we do, buy, or eat is based on oil. That is limited, and the supply may be running out. Will we be able to function, or will we enter a very dark time? And why don't more of the public, or even our families, want to hear about it? Kathy McMahon is a New England clinical psychologist who specializes in the stress and distress caused on discovery of peak oil. Peak oil is when the world reaches its highest point of production and then heads into a decline while reaching into the most polluting sources, like the tar sands, mountaintop removal for coal, or deep sea drilling, or even coal to oil conversion. Kathy runs a blog called peakoilblues.com, peakoilblues.com. From all over the world, worried people write in to talk about their experiences now that they know. Alex Smith recorded Kathy's speech in Vancouver, Canada on October 18, 2010. A cut-down version was broadcast on Radio EcoShock, but you are about to hear the whole speech, 80 minutes long, available in two parts. This is part one, 38 minutes long, starting with an introduction by John Cooksey, producer of the film How to Boil a Frog.
I met Kathy in the process of making a movie called How to Boil a Frog, which is now done. And in the process of that, a friend named Anita Burke and also Rex were trying to widen my view from climate change, which I was obsessively focused on as our certain doom, and trying to widen my view to other forms of doom. And Anita sent me a chart that had like all the world's problems on it, and I was completely overwhelmed. And so I just sort of stuck my finger on something, and it was peak oil. And then 6 months later, I emerged from the abyss. But in that time, a number of things happened after coming across peak oil, and I don't know how, I assume most of you here are familiar with it, and possibly the process of getting into it, but those things included becoming persona non grata in my own family. I was not allowed to actually speak when I went upstairs anymore. And after a while, I just stopped talking to strangers because it was just not a rewarding experience. You know, let me explain to you why everything you see is a mirage. See, none of this is real. When you go to the supermarket, those strawberries, they don't exist, right? So what that led me to was a circle of friends. I'll talk about that in a sec. But it also led me to Kathy because I was really interested in the psychology of it, including my own psychology. And I found Kathy just by email, and I think I sent her a copy of the rough cut or something, which she inexplicably liked, and we started corresponding, and we've been corresponding for like 2 years or something now. Finally, we did speak on the phone actually once, and I got more marital therapy in an hour on the phone with this woman in Massachusetts than I'd gotten in 20 years of therapy previous to that. So if you want to get ripped up in a serious way by somebody who actually understands the issues, I recommend an hour on the phone with her. So that was kind of how I got to know her, and we talked about the psychology of why the world is not changing in the face of what we face. But, you know, it's also more personal than that. It's also the way that we feel and the way that I felt, the struggles that I've gone through in a number of ways that she's going to talk about. But I wanted to say something that grew out of that was, you know, she sent me an email and said, hey, I'm coming to the West Coast. Do you think I could meet a few people? And now she's meeting like 1,000 people. And bringing her here, and Vandy's hosting her, Vandy Savage here, and we're kind of driving around, taking her to people. And what I notice as I take her to meet all the people here that are a lot of really cool people is that they're all my friends. Like, I'm taking her to meet my friends. And these are people I met through taking action around this issue and other issues. And I could say I'm taking her around to thought leaders or activists or whatever, but what they have in common is, like, they're all my friends and I love them. So I really encourage you, you know, I mean, Brandon has laid out some things to come do. You have no excuse to not know how to grow a chicken, and Ross is doing stuff all the time about, you know, how to feed yourself and how to transition. And I encourage you to do it to save your own life, but more than that, I encourage you because it is truly the end of loneliness. And I think it's a lot of what Kathy and I have in common. You'll hear is just the answer is there. The answer is in just making more friends and getting closer to the people that you love. And she's one of those people for me. So anyway, I want to have her up now. Thanks.
Let me ask you here, how many of you are familiar with peak oil? Just raise your hand. And how many of you were freaked out when you heard about peak oil? Okay. And I ask that question because I think when you really get it on an emotional level, what we're talking about, and it happens in adulthood, because I know that some people get it when they're really young. And for them, they grew up knowing about peak oil, and so that by the time they became adults and it became something that was more common in the literature, they didn't have the same reaction as somebody who learned about it when they were an adult. So my experience in learning about peak oil was 5 years ago, and a friend of ours sent us, told us about it, my husband and I remember it really clearly because we were doing over our floor in wood, and so we moved into another bedroom, in this little tiny bedroom, and he would go to research peak oil, and then he would come back with printouts, and he'd hand them to me like this, and he'd go, read this. So I would read this stuff, and I'd go, wow, man. And a half hour later, he'd come in with another thing, and he'd go, read this. And he was a speed reader, so he was bringing stuff in a lot faster than I could comprehend. But it emotionally really upset me to the core, because I was a middle-class professional, and I, you know, just assumed that this here was normal. And so learning about peak oil was deeply disturbing to me, and I thought to myself, well, you know, what can I do? I'm a psychologist. And I thought, well, ding dong, you saw how nutty you acted. And they always say that psychologists are kind of nutty anyway. So I wanted to see if, in fact, the general public reacted to learning about peak oil in the same way that I did. So I started a website called Peak Oil Blues. How many of you are familiar with Peak Oil Blues? Okay. And how many have been reading it for a while? It always shocks me when anyone reads it. Okay, thank you. And so what I did with Peak Oil Blues is basically ask people, what was your emotional reaction to learning about peak oils? Send me an email. And how did it change your life? What did you start to do differently than you did before? And so what happened is I got letters from people all over the world. I mean, I'm talking about tiny little specific islands, the Swiss Alps, you know, all over the United States, all over Canada. Australia has a really big active peak oil movement, and I got a lot of letters from Australia. But literally, I had readers in every continent and people who would say to me, thank you. And that was the strongest reaction that I got. They kept saying, thank you for doing this for us. The experience was like talking to a community of people, because basically what I was saying to them is, oh, yeah, that happened to me too. Oh, yeah, I felt that exact same way. Oh, yeah, well, here's what you're going to experience next. It wasn't just what I said to people who emailed me and posted, but it was also what people wrote in that was so reassuring to other people. And that's what one of the things that I'm going to go over tonight. So I'm going to cover these four issues, and I'm going to end up with talking about what I think are some of the basic strategies for keeping one's sanity through this whole process. So let me first talk about the dilemma. Peak oil is not a problem, because a problem has solutions. Peak oil is a dilemma. And the difference between a problem and a dilemma is a very important one psychologically. Because for a variety of reasons, people like to solve problems, but people hate dilemmas, because whichever way you go to try to mitigate a dilemma, you create other problems. And so for a lot of my readers, a lot of my contributors, they stopped knowing what to wish for. If they wished for the end of oil, they got a planet. But if they hoped that we would never run out of oil, they got dramatic climate change. So it was always between a rock and a hard place. So I want to talk to you about the person who first faced this dilemma. This is a picture of Cassandra, and she's a Greek character She was given the gift to be able to predict the future, but unfortunately, she really ticked off Apollo. And he couldn't take away her powers, but what he did is say to her, you will never be believed when you tell people what's coming. So I want to introduce you to the first Cassandra that I was aware of in the United States. And this was President Jimmy Carter 33 years ago. He basically, and I want to tell you his story very briefly, but if you're interested, it's worth the time to go and to Google the energy speech for Jimmy Carter, and the speech is there, and it's in writing as well as him speaking it. But I'm going to give you a very brief version of what he said. He said, let me start with a history lesson on energy. He said, a long time ago, when we needed energy, we burned wood. And in fact, we burned so much wood that 90% of our energy needs were met with wood. After that, we discovered coal. And coal was such a much more intense form of energy for us that it enabled us to begin the Industrial Revolution and put a lot of people to work, a lot of children to work. And after that, we discovered this cool thing called natural gas and oil. And the one thing that we needed to understand about oil is that, according to Jimmy Carter, it was the densest energy source on the face of the planet. It was so dense that if you fill your tank with the stuff, you can move 2 tons of metal 350 to 400 miles. I mean, that's incredible amount of energy in a very little space. And I think it's hard for us to grasp how powerful and how concentrated oil actually is. So he basically said it gave us things like automobiles and airplanes. And the important thing he said is we have never known anything else. And this was 33 years ago, so it's even more true now, that we just assume that having access to natural gas and oil is natural. And he said the problem is that it's a finite substance, and we are burning through 60 million barrels of oil every single day across the planet. He said in 1950, we burned twice as much oil as we did in 1940, and in 1960, we burned twice as much as we did in 1950. And he said in each of those decades, we burned more oil than the entire history of the planet. So he said, what has happened is that the United States is the most wasteful nation on Earth. And he said, we drive these gas-guzzling cars. He said, and it's the moral equivalent of war. So important is this energy issue that we have to begin a campaign as a nation to rally around like we would a war to really tackle this issue seriously. He said we have to go on a very strict conservation program. We have to start to turn our heat down. We have to start insulating our homes because he said more oil is wasted going out our windows and walls than we import every year. So he said we have to beef up our public transportation and get away from private automobiles. We have to turn towards alternative energies like solar and wind technology. And I'll show you how. So he said, first, turn your heat down. Wear a sweater, you know. Get your wife to wear a sweater. Put a solar panel, like I'm doing right here on the White House. And if you don't, here's the problem. And it was like the Lost in Space robot. He said, you know, warning, warning, there will be tremendous environmental damage if you don't do that. Here are some of the things he said are going to happen. He said, number one, we're going to be going into areas to try to get the last drops of oil in places that we don't want to go because it's going to create a huge mess for us. He said, we're going to go into areas to find coal and dig up and cut up the landscape in horrific ways. He said, we're going to start building nuclear power plants quickly. Now, think about that. Many of us don't want nuclear power plants built slowly. We certainly don't want them built at the speed of life, you know, or death, as the case may be. So he said, this is what we need to tackle. So then the election came, and we had a choice. Were we going to go with Debbie Downer and the first lady casual who was wearing sweaters, or were we going to go with a cowboy who basically would have wives and a wife in a lovely evening gown, you know, many, many evening gowns, and we could leave our heat up as high as we wanted. We could drive the big cars. It wasn't important. It didn't matter. And we would all make lots of money, and hooray, we would have a major party and take those stupid solar panels off the White House. So that's what we did. And we became the absurdly most wasteful nation on Earth. And instead of burning through 60 million barrels of oil a day, we burned through 84 million barrels a day across the world. But we only have one world. And 20% of us are taking in and using up 80% of the stuff on Earth. So what we found out is that we have this massive footprint, this massive impact, that 20% on the planet itself. And we are creating enormous environmental degradation. In fact, one of the agencies that helps people who are suffering from environmental climate dysregulation, like tsunamis and floods and all that kind of stuff, they have to service the same number of people as live in Indonesia, and that's the fourth largest nation on the planet. Now, the scary thing is they said within 5 years they're going to have to start servicing the same number of people that live in the United States and Canada. And the United States is the third largest, most populated country in the world. You know, when are we going to wake up? Are we going to go for India, which is the second, and then for China, and pretty soon they're going to have to help all of us? So environmental degradation isn't something that we're unaware of. In fact, this study by Porter Novelli, which is not at all an activist group, it's a PR firm, basically said that 80% of the people agreed, more or less, that it's a very serious problem. And it's something that it threatens the life on the planet. Only 14% thought it really wasn't any problem. It gets worse because we got older in those last 33 years. And the baby boomers are like a big rat moving through a python, you know, because everything we hit, we dramatically change. And now the baby boomers are starting to age. And everything that you see here in this hospital examining room is all made of oil. In fact, 85% of everything we have has some component of oil in it, including medication. And 96%, 95, 96, 97% uses oil to make it. So this is not a small problem. Now, the other thing that's happening in the United States, and apparently up here, you folks, it hasn't hit yet, although I did send John Cooksey a game, and the game was try to guess if this house is a crack house or a million-dollar mansion. How many of you have seen that game? Nobody can win it because the crack houses, you know, look like million-dollar mansions in Vancouver, and the million-dollar mansions look like crack houses. So that's the way it was in the United States not too long ago. And people had the interest rate was so low like it is here in Canada, people were buying these houses that they literally were just barely able to afford before the crash. What we found out, this is from a website called Stockbrokers with Their Hands on Their Face. And And that's all it has, is pictures of stockbrokers with their hands on their face. That's what happened, is that all of a sudden, the bubble, which really didn't need to be an energy bubble, but the bubble burst, and it certainly wasn't helped by the high price of gasoline. At that point, I use this for Americans, but I wanted you to see this just so you could be educated when people say, well, you know, the problem with America is they're spending so much money on. Well, the blue part here is the amount of money we gave to Wall Street to try to bail it out for the crapola that happened down there. The reddish, you know, here is all of what the costs are for the Iraq and Afghanistan war, and you see that it's a tiny sliver. This green area here is what all of the 2010 healthcare reform bill we're planning. We don't have any public health care in the United States, which some of you are well aware of. And that purple is the stimulus bill that Obama had that unfortunately is putting brand new highways all over the United States, or repairing the highways we have, because, you know, goodness knows that what we need as we're facing oil depletion is more highways. But the last sliver is what we gave the banks the last time that they ran into problems in 1987. So basically, what I'm trying to say to you is that if you were to add all of these together and put them in a pie, we gave the banks so much money, but all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put our economy back together again. So we began to face a massive credit crunch, and I was really on the front lines of this because when I started Peak Oil Blues, we ran in a business that was working with builders. We provided them with kitchen and laundry appliances. And everything was going gangbusters for a while, and then suddenly it dropped out. I mean, we had builders we were working with for 12 years that suddenly would call us and say, hey, you know, I'd like to pay you. I know we owe you 10 grand, but we're going to try to sell our condo in Florida, and maybe we can get some money to start paying off. These people had 12, 15 workers. And now they were down to working just themselves. The crash was incredible, and it happened all over our country. And so we started with building McMansions like this, and then suddenly this is what happened. They were just abandoned. And that really crashed an enormous number of other businesses that were all connected to housing. So I want to show you this slide because this relates to what's going on again to the south of the border here. That's the unemployment rate for three states that are pretty close to you. There's two numbers that I want you to pay attention to. There's the top one here, and you see that according to the official unemployment rate, Oregon has a 10.6% unemployment rate. But there's a lot of funny business that went into coming up with this figure. And if you begin to look at government figures that include back things like people who just gave up looking for work because they were so disheartened that they couldn't find any work, or you include back into that figure people who basically are working part-time, but they really need a full-time job, but as part-time is as good as they can get, you have to add 12% onto any unemployment figures that you're hearing from the United States. So what you see here is in dramatically different numbers, okay? During the last Great Depression, at the very height of it, the United States suffered a 25% unemployment rate. By the way, Canada's unemployment rate at the height of the Great Depression was even higher than the United States. So just to quickly show you that we're not really very far away from those earlier numbers. And in addition to that, we're a bigger nation than we used to be. And so whereas during the Great Depression, we had more than a quarter of a million people who were homeless, today we have 3.5 million people. Now, if you're like me, numbers are kind of hard to grasp. So what I've done is I've basically told you that this is sort of like the population of Greater Minneapolis. That's how many people have no place to call home tonight. And in terms of foreclosures, which is basically the banks taking back houses, people leaving, they call it jingle mail, putting the keys in an envelope and sending it back to the bank. That used to be a half million during the last Great Depression, and right now it's 7.5 million people, which is the population of Israel. So we have a huge problem on our hands, and that problem doesn't get any better by ignoring it. But one of the things that happens with dilemmas is that public officials realize that they can't win when they start to deal with dilemmas. Because no matter which way they go, no matter what they propose, they can have a group of people saying, you're making things worse, and those people would be right. So for the most part, the way that politicians deal with this situation, this dilemma, is they ignore it. They pretend it doesn't exist. What I want to talk about is that the psychological reactions that people have in living in this sort of environment. As I mentioned, a dilemma is not a problem. Here's a Woody Allen description of a dilemma. What it says is, mankind faces a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness, the other to total extinction. Let us pray we have the wisdom to choose correctly. So, you know, basically it's would you like to be blind or would you like your tongue cut out? And people say, I don't want either of those, but that's what we're facing. Here's another definition. It's offering a solution or possibility, none of which are really practically acceptable. Or the Chinese who say, to advance or to retreat is equally difficult. That's what a dilemma is. And when you first learn about the dilemmas of peak oil, climate change, and economic hard times, my contributors were shocked, just as I was. They would, like I did, start to read intensively everything they could get their hands on. Now, here's the thing. The more scientifically oriented they were, the more nights they would spend not being able to sleep, working overtime to try to find that solution that would make everything better. Because they couldn't believe, if you're an engineer, you're taught, you're paid to solve problems. And so I'd have engineers writing to me and saying, this is the third night I have not been able to sleep, because usually I have a problem, I go to bed, and in the morning I've solved it, because I'm a really smart guy. But with peak oil, I haven't been able to solve it, and it's driving me crazy. Another reaction that's really common is that they feel like they're hitting up against an invisible wall. That no matter what they do, no matter what path they go down to try to grasp the intensity of this issue, it just feels like a dead end for them. The other common reaction, another one, is that how many of you have seen the movie The Matrix? If you've seen The Matrix, one of the things that you know is that they live in a pod, in a kind of dim, grim environment, but they're able to project themselves into a world that's much like our own. And when people first learn about peak oil, their experience is that they go and study about this stuff, living in this grim world of the future that they're anticipating. And then they go out and they take an airplane flight, or they go into a supermarket. Everything is there for them. And it seems like they must be crazy. And so they go back into the pod, back into the reading, intensive reading. They learn more. They go back out. The outside world, the Matrix world, feels real to them initially. And that pod feels fake, despite the fact that they keep reading and they keep not being able to disprove what they're learning. But an interesting thing happens. After a while, they start to feel alienated from the Matrix. And they start to feel like that's not real. The pod is real. And so all of the things that they initially began to feel like they were going to miss once peak oil crashed, they now start to feel are needed to go away, because if it doesn't go away, our planet is going to crash. So people get to the point where they're not quite sure what to wish for, because anything they wish for will bring calamity. But I think that's a very interesting distinction and reaction and change that happens to people, that they start to become alienated from that very thing that they began to fear that they would miss terribly. Another reaction that they have that's very common is that what I call nostalgia for the present. They'll go into a supermarket and they'll look at a whole thing. We did it today. Fruit from all over the world, fish, meat. I mean, just overwhelmed by the choices. And they'll say, I remember when you could just go into a market and you could buy anything you wanted, and it was really cheap. And they felt crazy because here they were in that market and they could buy anything and it was really relatively cheap. But they were in that pod looking from those eyes, seeing how temporary and how illusionary it all was. Let me just say one more thing. They also would walk down a city street, and instead of seeing the cars in the parking lot and the buildings all lit up, they would see boarded up buildings and abandoned cars. I mean, obviously they wouldn't see it, but that's how they began to interpret the world around them, with that mask, if you will, of oil removed. The other thing that was very common among my contributors is a feeling of shame and guilt, because they began to become aware that they really were the 20% that were sucking up. They were big, fat planet killers that were just sucking up all the resources, and that people everywhere else in the world were being used and exploited for them to be able to live a very luxurious life. So that shame was very powerful, and especially among my older contributors who would feel like they had created a horrible nightmare for their children and their grandchildren. Depression was common. And one of the things I'm most proud of is before I started Peak Oil Blues, well, I'm not proud of this, but before I started, I got two stories of people, young men, who had killed themselves. And in their suicide note, it basically said, what's the point of living? We're going to be running out of oil. And when we do, I'm going to die anyway. So I don't want to live through a future like that, and I'm going to kill myself now. What I'm proud of is that since I started my website, I haven't heard another story like that. So I believe, based on that, and I know I would hear about it, I believe based on that that I am serving a function of having young people be able to write me and talk about it and see that the reactions that they're going through are not unusual and weird, and that there are things that they can do, which I'll talk about in a minute. We all have our various ways, you know. Being a psychologist, I use my adaptive strategies. Some of us, you know, are going to use more drugs and alcohol to manage the strain. But one of the things that I've come to grips with is that peak oil makes us all gamblers, and climate change for that matter, and even economic hard times ahead. And I got that because 5 years ago, I was aware. In fact, if you go into my site, you can research this. I wrote about the fact that we were going to be facing a bubble, or we had a bubble in our housing market, and it was going to explode. And yet here I was with a family business that was in that market. Did I close it down? No. I was betting on the lucky sevens. Every year that went by, I kept saying, okay, give me it, give me the number eight. I was a gambler. Because what I realized was the emotions that we were dealing with were going to be like this either way I went. If we sold the business, we'd have to sort of look into, now what are we going to do for a business? If we didn't sell the business, then we could at least hold on, hoping that the tracks would last a little longer. Because to get off that track meant we had to tip the train over, and that was going to be enormous amounts of damage. Again, a lot of my contributors felt like they were sitting on the train, they just ordered an aperitif, and they're waiting for dinner, and they look out the window, and this is what they're seeing ahead of them. But the most difficult problem that most of my contributors talk about extensively is the emotional reactions that they get when they start to talk about these issues with their friends and family. Even their spouses are often hostile to the idea that this is even a possibility. And so because we have names like Debbie Downer for people who believe that we're facing really serious problems in the future, I thought it would be helpful to talk about people who were pathologically hopeful. And I called them Panglossian. So I developed a category of Panglossian disorders. And I realized that all of us in the peak oil movement were like this Superman cartoon. You know, for those of you who are listening, you've got two Supermen having a beer. And one looks at the other and says, "Oh, man, you save people from themselves? Wow, that's a tough gig." And yet that's how we were feeling, that we couldn't do it alone. If we didn't have a community that was going to come along with us, we were even more doomed. So we try and talk with people, but instead of being receptive, we were feeling increasingly isolated, which is exactly what we didn't want to happen. We'd be sitting at the dinner table. "Well, dear," this is a family dinner table, "well, what do you want to be when you grow up, Jane?" And Jane says, "Well, Dad, I'd like to still be alive." And that's the seriousness with which my contributors were feeling that things had gotten to. So here's my definition of what happens when you go to a therapist to talk about this stuff and they have no clue what you're talking about. They tend to pathologize because they don't know any better. And so psychological terrorism is the phenomenon of pathologizing emotional reactions when they're perfectly appropriate given what the person is going through. I don't like the idea of categories like post-petroleum stress disorder. I think we have enough problems. We don't need to start pathologizing ourselves. Yes, we want to be have our emotions be legitimized by professionals. But I don't think it's helpful to say that we're pathological because we're experiencing these things. So I'm going to give you a few Panglossian disorders that I'm going to go through kind of quickly with you. The first, of course, is just pure denial. You know, that can't be right. Oh, come on, you're making that up. Now, the difference between pure denial and somebody who just disagrees with you is that someone in pure denial doesn't bother to look into it. Just rejects it out of hand because you said it. So it's like an electrician saying to you, your electricity in your house is so badly wired that it's going to burn up your house, probably in the next 6 months. And you say, "Oh, go away. That's ridiculous." Okay? As opposed to saying, "Well, maybe I'll look and get a second opinion about that." So this would drive people crazy. They would say, "Look, why don't you just look into it, please? I'm married to you. I think our future is just blown up. I really want to take steps to protect our children, to change our lifestyle. Look into it." And they would hear from their spouses or their families, "No, I don't need to look into it. I don't want to look into it." Another is minimalization. "Okay, you know, maybe we're going to have problems. But you are blowing it way out of proportion. It's not going to be as bad as you say it is." And both of these reactions are sort of like, "What, me worried? No problem." Another is what I call Frank Zappa-ism. Frank Zappa had a band called the Mothers of Invention. And basically this disorder says that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And as soon as things get wicked, wicked bad, they'll just invent something.
That was part one of a speech by Kathy McMahon, The Peak Shrink, recorded in Vancouver, Canada on October 18, 2010. Find part two of this important speech either at ecoshock.org on the Peak Oil page or at archive.org. Kathy's blog is peakoilblues.com.